Energy Transition, episode number 45. This is the first one of 2023. Our topic today is climate change narrative shifts. Good morning, Elin Slav, David Blackman, and welcome to our new member, Tammy Nimet.
Hi, everybody. Nice to meet you all.
Good morning and Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year to everyone.
You too. Let me show something. No more cries of climate change. Is climate change becoming unimportant, Elin Slav?
Well, no, but it has become temporarily, I assume, less important than energy security. Because what the media, especially in Europe, have been celebrating is warmer than usual weather. And it has been really, really warm. Unnaturally warm. And any other year, I'm just sure about it, any other year, there would have been alarmist headlines, climate change is here, winters are getting warm, we're getting no snow. But this winter, I only saw one such headline. It was about alpine ski resorts that don't have any snow, and this is tragic because, it's a big business. And climate change is wrecking this business.
David, Bloomberg mentioned that in the U.S. domestic gas rate is falling, and nobody's talking about climate change at this time.
Well, yeah, other than hyping up the rain that's happening in California, where a year ago we were mired in a permanent drought because of climate change. Now climate change is causing unusually heavy rains in what our weather people are alarmistly calling bomb cyclones, which we used to refer to as the Pineapple Express, that, storms that have existed throughout recorded time and unrecorded time. And it's been warm. It's going to be warm in Texas this week. We're going to have an 80 degree high on Wednesday. But at my house, I'm getting ready for late January when it looks like Texas could be hit once again with a major winter storm. And I think much of Europe could be hit with a big winter storm the last week in January, because there's an enormous dome of Arctic air building above the North Pole in the Arctic region that long-term weather forecasts show coming down into Europe and North America that last week in January. So I suspect the narrative at that point will then change right back again to alarmism about climate change, because that's what we do these days.
Mm-hmm. Tammy, so what's the reason in your vision that narratives are so tendency, they are unpredictable in terms of energy transition? We cannot understand the trends.
Well, I think there's within the progressive movement that's behind a lot of the climate change narrative, there's a vested interest in never being able to pin it down, that it's always changing. Because if it's always changing, then it's very hard to criticize. Because, I think people, opponents of what's happening, they fixate on one thing and then the narrative changes, and then they have to pivot right away and try to bring up more evidence for whatever they're pushing back against on the new narrative. So there's this fuzziness, and the ever shifting ground is part of the process, really, because that gives them more power to assert the changes that they want and keep people off balance. And I think that's the big thing, is keeping people and those people who would be fighting against it off balance, so that they can push ahead with the transition in the manner that the Europeans, for example, wish to move forward.
Good, Elena. You see that Europe, especially in Bulgaria, is so different, the climate, from other parts of the Earth, compared to United States. What's the reason and how people are seeing this difference? Because they're on the same level, no?
We have a temperate climate. throughout Europe, but of course, Northern Europe has longer winters and shorter summers, while Southern Europe, where I am, has four really, well, they used to be distinct, but because of climate change, they're no longer so distinct, these four seasons. But I don't know how people across Europe are seeing this, but I have to agree with Tammy. She really puts it very aptly that the important thing of the climate change narrative is to, that's why it stopped being global warming and it became climate change, because obviously we're not just seeing a warming. And even right now that we are actually seeing a natural warming, though I'm not so sure this is the first time in history that winter has been this warm, I actually really doubt it. Nobody's talking about it, not in mainstream media, not officials, government officials or EU officials. I mean, they had a great opportunity to say, see, winter is so unnaturally warm, we need more wind and solar. They're not saying this. They're saying we won the energy crisis. We will survive winter. But as David said, winter is not over. I don't know. It feels stupid to have to remind this because it's just January. And my husband, by the way, is preparing for really cold weather, even if it's not on the short-term forecast. But it's early days, and January tends to be colder than December. So, they will probably start shouting about climate change when it gets naturally cold for this time of the year.
Yeah, you know, where I am, it's very often this temperature that we're seeing this week, the warmer temperatures, that happens all the time and has always happened all the time. The climate is changing, I think, in various ways, and there, I don't think there's really any question about that. I think the big questions are what's causing it, and even more important, what are the right solutions, right? And this narrative that wind and solar are the solution, regardless of what the question is a dangerous thing, a very dangerous thing, because they're obviously not the solution to every situation. They're fine energy generating resources in certain situations and when managed properly in an integrated grid. But our problem has been in the United States, and I think some other places in the world, that grid managers have a very difficult time properly managing and integrating them into their grids and maintaining stability at the same time. And the other danger we face, I think, is the fact that so many, so much of our money is being focused, our investment dollars are being focused on overbuilding wind and solar. That it's taking away, it's depriving other sources of energy like thermal energy and nuclear of adequate investment for the additional capacity they need to keep these grids stable. And we see the consequences of that every time we have a big winter storm here in the United States and in Europe. But the positive, of course, is that, you know, officials are right to be boasting about the warm weather helping their natural gas situation and helping to ensure they'll get through the winter and still have some natural gas left. So that's a positive thing about this weather.
Yeah, but it's not like they made the weather warm.
Right, exactly.
It just happened this way. It was pure stroke of luck. But there's something else, and Reuters' John Kemp mentioned it in a recent column, that the gas storage in Europe is not a strategic reserve. It's a seasonal reserve. You can't fill it above 100%. I mean, you can just fill it so far. And whether you will end the winter season with a lot of gas or not so much gas depends entirely on the weather. Sure, Germany is building floating LNG import terminals. That's great for Germany. We saw last month a rare reversal of usual trends with LNG gas going into storage rather than being drawn out of storage. But that's only because we got lucky with the weather. And I'm not sure how lucky we are because, you know, a warm winter, a snowless winter is not good news for harvest next year.
Yeah.
Let me.
Well, I just wanted to add to that. I noticed that Biden put out his call to refill the SPR back in November. And then they just announced, was it on the weekend, that, oh, yeah, we don't like those bids. We're not going to refill it just now.
Yeah.
So,
makes sense. So it's not strategic.
I guess it is strategic, but they're like pretending it isn't. So
sure. If you do not have the resource, it's not strategic.
Yeah, amazingly.
Tell me, what's the reason that the famous chief of International Energy Agency, Mr. Birol, said that in 2023, the situation of Europe will be worse than 2022. What's the reason? Isn't it something?
Oh, there's lots of speculation about why that narrative has been going out there, right? I mean, they've been repeating this ad nauseum for the past 6 months that 2023 is going to be worse than 2022. People better get prepared, get ready for getting used to new habits, I guess. Of how they consume their energy. And, you know, why they say that, it's a bit of, are they broadcasting that they don't want an agreement with Russia? And if there is an agreement with Russia, they're not going to return to using any Russian oil and gas? I don't know. But it seems it goes in line with what the Europeans want to change in how people live their lives. And it's just sort of, in my view, laying the groundwork for people to get used to it, to get used to not, you know, turning the heat up and having cold showers and maybe not eating as much meat because everything's too expensive. So it's strange. Irina, what do you think of his comments?
It's a type of control.
Well, yeah. Centralized control. That's the main point. Well, fundamentally, there's not as much Russian pipeline gas. There will not be as much pipeline gas from Russia this year as there was last year. That's the basic level. But what Tammy said is totally accurate. The European officials, our centralized government in the face of the European Commission and the European Parliament, are trying to effect a change in behavioral patterns, because when there is no Russian gas and pipeline gas is the cheapest gas, and pipeline gas coming into Europe now comes only from Norway. Well, some comes from Russia, but you know, the most reliable partner is Norway. The rest is LNG. I mean, last year Europe turned into the biggest LNG importer in the world, overtaking Japan and China and all of the big Asian consumers. But LNG is quite a bit more expensive than pipeline gas, and there is no, I think there is no European country that has pockets deep enough to sustain this rate of LNG imports without its economy paying a very steep price. So if you're switching from dependence on a politically incorrect and unfriendly supplier to a politically correct and supposedly friendly supplier whose commodity is a lot more expensive than the first one, then you will need to, you know, train people to consume less energy, because prices are not going down. How much lower can LNG prices get, especially now that there's talk that China is reopening, and this means returning energy demand, including for LNG?
You in UK and Bulgaria probably are using thermostat control at this time, thermostat limits. It's not the case of David that's free of thermostat.
We haven't gotten there yet in Texas.
Thermostat free.
Yeah, in Brazil it's not necessary because our climate is fantastic, that we do not have winter and summer too hot. But are you still using thermostat limits? The control are in use?
I'm not. we have a fireplace and some heaters for the bedrooms. So, no, we have no centralized heating system, which is great, I think.
Yeah, our central heat is like normal, a normal thermostat, just where we set one temperature for the whole house. When we lived in Germany, it was different. We had individual, you could put it on your radiator and regulate the temperature for each radiator for each room, which was very different than the UK. But yeah, in the UK, we live in an old house and it has one thermostat for the whole house.
Yeah. In the United States, you know, it differs from state to state, obviously. In California, there are mandates and incentives to install the smart thermostats that enable utility companies to control them from a central location at the behest of the government, which, you know, I think obviously the climate planners want to make those universal so that your thermostats can be controlled from a central location. They just haven't succeeded politically in forcing that on everyone everywhere. Our thermostats in our house in Texas, a lot of people have the smart thermostats. We continue to use stupid thermostats that we can only control. And I'm going to continue to avoid the smart thermostats for as long as I can, you know, until they're mandated. And inevitably, I think, given the voting trends here in the United States, I think inevitably we'll all have to have a smart thermostat that can be centrally controlled within the next 10 to 20 years.
They've been trialing that in the UK, where they'll have, during this crisis, they took, I think, 4,000 homes or something and said, we'd like to have the power to moderate your electricity when necessary. Yeah. And if they are banning natural gas boilers, and eventually everyone's going to have to be on electricity and everyone's going to have an electric vehicle, there's not enough power. So this is the solution to, I guess, solve that problem is being able to control how everybody uses their energy. But it's just a trial right now. I think they're trying to see what the reception rate is like, how it's going to work, and then eventually roll it out, probably county by county, then nationally. I don't know.
Yeah.
Is there, Irina, a strategic plan to take control in terms of energy, to force the energy transition? You see?
Well, the way you put it, it sounds like an evil plan. I don't know if it's really an evil plan whose purpose is control. But I do believe that the European Commission and the rest of the European Union institutions sincerely believe that they know best what's good for us, and they should be making more and more decisions instead of national government. This to me is obviously very concerning, not because the national government of Bulgaria or previous governments or the current one are particularly knowledgeable and expert in anything, but because this means loss of sovereignty.
Yeah.
And this is why I think we're seeing such a wave of nationalist parties winning elections in Europe, because people are not ready to give up their sovereignty.
I agree completely with that. It's this idea that they know better. They know better how to spend your money. They know better how to run everything.
It's like, and it's like kind of control.
Yeah. But again, it's not a, I don't think it's a conspiracy, because they're explaining exactly what they're planning to do. So
not a hidden idea. It's
not a hidden idea. It's
very, very open.
Yeah.
They do believe their own propaganda. They do believe that the transition will be good for everyone and the planet, which it won't, but those bureaucrats, because they are, truly believe that this is the way forward. It will be good for everyone, it will be better for everyone, or at least for most people, which again, it won't. But, they're cherry picking their facts, they're being one-sided the whole time, highlighting the pros and totally ignoring the cons. There was This week there was a great column in the Times. Somebody had photographed it from the paper issue of the newspaper about a journalist who bought an electric vehicle. And he had, did you read it?
Yeah, that was so funny.
I'm sorry, I forgot his name, but this man said that the electric car he bought 2 years ago has been nothing but trouble. And it finally died on him in the middle of the road, and it could not be revived. And they had, he and his family had to walk the rest of the way to their house. Luckily, they were about a mile away or a kilometer away, so they were kind of nearby. But it was really, as one Twitter user called it, it's really bad PR for electric vehicles. And electric vehicles are considered one of the, you know, the main ways that we will decarbonize. But if this is happening to high-end electric vehicles, because it was a very high-end brand, this electric car, what happens to the lower-end vehicles?
Well, like there's a group in Canada called the Cascade Institute, and one of their scholars, Angela V. Carter, wrote a paper a couple of years ago about how they need to do to the automobile industry, even electric ones, the same way that the campaign was against the tobacco industry. And the motivation is that electric vehicles are still a drain on the new system that they want. And so therefore they need to get people out of cars in general.
Right.
So it's pushing the Ubers, the, you know, ride sharing, transit, biking, walking, which then ties into what Oxford is doing with their six zones, and you can't drive only 100 days a year. So 2/3 of the time you have a vehicle, you can't use it.
Right.
Great way to discourage car ownership, by the way.
Yeah.
Hey, we have a question from a viewer. Substack contributor Doomberg is predicting the elimination of oil-fueled furnaces and the mandating of inefficient heat pumps. David, have you seen an indication of this? I think that's certainly a known goal of the climate change folks, to get rid of these oil-fueled furnaces and the use of fuel oil in power generation and home heating in general, just as they want to eliminate coal and eventually want to eliminate natural gas. And, you know, I mean, it's just not achievable with wind and solar. I always people think that I oppose wind and solar power, and I don't. I just think that wind and solar power are not the full solution to an energy transition, and never can be, just due to the laws of physics and thermodynamics. But they're fine in certain applications. But the thought that in Wall Street Journal, you talk about great media stories. Wall Street Journal ran a piece a week ago about an effort in one province in Spain to force Alcoa to electrify one of their smelter plants that requires 400 megawatts of energy to run 24 hours a day. And they're trying to force them to electrify with wind only. And they're going to build this gigantic wind farm encircling a poor village named Foz in Spain. And in order to run this power plant or this smelting plant that requires 400 megawatts of energy, they have to build 2 gigawatts of wind capacity to ensure the windmills will turn often enough to generate 400 megawatts. So think of the incredible waste of resources and labor and time and land that has to be condemned to house the wind farm that represents. And these folks think they can do this all over the face of the earth. And this is a long-winded way of getting around to the point I'm trying to make, which is that wind and solar have the same resource limitations that oil and gas do. There's a limited amount of oil and gas on the face of the earth. Wind and solar require an amazing amount of critical minerals to build their turbines and also provide battery backup if they ever really get around to doing that. And there's not enough lithium and cobalt and copper and all these other critical minerals that they must have for these batteries on the face of the earth to do this globally. And so, you know, I'm not necessarily opposed to a clean energy transition, but it's not going to be accomplished with wind and solar power only. It's going to require really what the world really needs is the breakthrough in nuclear fusion that everyone has been promising for half a century to actually take place. And then you can think about a real energy transition, but trying to do it with wind and solar is incredibly costly and wasteful, and we need to be smarter about this.
And do not forget about petrochemical products. Irinislav wrote an article. This is the article that I love, Irina. And she mentioned exactly the needs that we have for petrochemical products that solar and wind cannot replace till this time.
Right.
Isn't it, Irina?
Yeah, you can't make plastics from electricity, sadly. Not yet.
Can you make it from hydrogen? I guess you could make it from hydrogen, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they can. They can. And do not forget that David has a Tesla electric vehicle at home. Huh?
No, I can't afford a Tesla, man. I have a Volvo, though.
People, was the first episode of 2023. It was a pleasure for me, Tammy Nimet, coming join us. Irinislav, as always, and David Blackman. Was a pleasure for me. Thank you so
me
much.
Me too.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you. A pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank
have
you.
A have great a great week.
Great week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.